It's a real privilege to be asked to contribute what are really inadequate remarks in this celebration of Ellie, and I'd like to thank the organisers for giving me the honour of taking part. I think I said most of what I really wanted to say about Ellie the man in my tribute to him in the European Journal blog in February, although I really should reiterate that he was a wonderful and inspiring teacher and an assiduous PhD supervisor, despite some of the misgivings he had about the broadly theoretical aspects of my research. I'm convinced that there were times he thought I was about to disappear up my own fundament. Honestly, yeah, this was particularly true when I developed what he thought was an unhealthy interest in logic. I've got over that. Now, what I'd like really to consider today is Ellie's not inconsiderable contribution to the doctrinal study of international litigation. Of course, his academic writings were informed by his practices, as Dame Rosalind said earlier today, but I think his achievement in this field has really been overlooked or overshadowed, possibly for two reasons, as Roger adverted to. One is the reputation of his father, who's regarded, after all, as a significant figure in this field, given his private law of sources and analogies, the function of law in the international community, and the development of law by the international court. I think the second factor is really Ellie's stellar reputation as an advisor, as an advocate, as an arbitrator, as well as his work for so many years with the international law reports. This might have led to the wrong impression that Ellie's contribution lay only in his practice and the substantive jurisprudence of international courts and tribunals. I should like to bring Ellie the academic out of these shadows by drawing on three principal doctrinal works. One was an article published in the late 1970s by the American branch of the International Law Association called Equity, Evasion, Equivocation, and Evolution in International Law. The second one is his Aspects of the Administration of International Justice, which was published in 1991. These were his lectures in honor of his father here. And finally, his Hague Academy lectures on principles of procedure in international litigation, which were published in 2011. These lectures had originally been delivered in 1996. So I've got to admit that I've only got admiration for such a gloriously missed publication deadline. I think it's great, it is a lesson to us all, but not if you're a student. Anyway, a striking characteristic of these three works lies not only in the substantive knowledge and reflective insights they contain, but also something that was apparent in Ellie's earlier series of lectures in the Hague Academy in 1977, which examined the development of the law of international organization by the decisions of international tribunals. These lectures demonstrated a drive for systematization, a search for common underlying principles which aim to unify specific areas of international law. This was really a clear intention of the earlier lectures, which did not discuss individual organizations in isolation, but tried to explore the common ground to uncover where the practice of one organization had influenced the practice of another. As far as I recall, this integrative approach was fairly unusual in the late 1970s. I think there were only one or two other commentators who were, in a way similarly exceptional, such as Wilfred Jenks. But I found a far more interesting and rewarding approach to the topic of international organizations than the bare recitation of the organs and competencies of particular organizations, which was standard at that time, and which, quite frankly, bored me rigid. Yeah, Ellie brought something new to the study of international organizations. You know, his work on international litigation, and in particular its procedural aspects, also take a broad view. They bring together the practice of diverse courts and tribunals. They try to uncover similarities, but they also discuss the differences in the way that international tribunals handle cases. Early, I think quite rightly, saw an understanding of procedure as a prominent part, Early saw the study of international procedure as crucial, but he also conceded in the Hague Academy lectures that the study of procedure, as he says, does not play a prominent part in the general syllabus of international dispute settlement. That is still far too true today. However, that concession by Early only led up to one of his classic comments. Procedure is to litigation what cooking is to food, which I quite liked. Anyway, in this brief comment, I cannot cover all of Early's incisive observations. I'm going to pick out two. One is his views on consent to international litigation. The other is his views on the notion of equity. I'm so glad that I decided not to look at judges ad hoc, because I wouldn't be saying anything because Dame Rosalind said it all earlier. Now, in both aspects of the administration of international justice and in his Hague Academy lectures, Early challenged the received wisdom that international litigation should be dependent on the consent of the parties. Partly he did this by burrowing under the formal surface of international law to discover the wealth of arrangements which functionally contradict consensual jurisdiction. But he also challenged its very conception. His aim was to question whether there was any continuing justification for, to use his words, this so-called general principle. He noted that its roots are historical. International arbitration preceded the emergence of international adjudication, but arbitration crucially relied on the party's consent because this was needed to create a tribunal in the first place. With permanent courts, however, consent is only practically necessary for the establishment of the court in the first place. But once it exists, then the need for consent in practical terms disappears. So for Early, the question was, why is consensual jurisdiction still included in the architecture of international courts? Now, on first glance, this might appear as a reversion to some of his father's views, mainly expressed in the function of law in the international community on the need for compulsory jurisdiction. But Early's approach and argument were different. Early's father argued for compulsory jurisdiction essentially because of his Kelsenite understanding of law. Implement a Kelsenite model of law, you need courts. And also, Ellie's father had a desire to demonstrate that things like vital interest clauses in arbitral agreements create a false dichotomy between legal and political disputes. Now, while Ellie freely accepted that all disputes have some legal element that can be processed and are thus amenable to international adjudication or arbitration, he saw the requirement of consensual jurisdiction as lying in late 19th century positive concepts of the absolute sovereignty of the state. He argued that this mindset is outmoded, as absolute conceptions of sovereignty have been eroded by developments in the structure and content of international law. For instance, with the increasing importance and prevalence of international organizations, and by the accumulation of treaties which include compromissory clauses which create compulsory mechanisms for the settlement at least of some disputes. Early identified trends in international jurisprudence where the strict requirement of consent had been relaxed or eroded, but saw one contrary trend in the international court, which is dealing with disputes which implicate third-party interests, either in matters of intervention or in the indispensable third-party doctrine. In his Hague Academy lectures, he was rather scathing about the monetary gold doctrine and its application in cases such as East Timor and phosphate lands in Nauru. Scathing is really an understatement. He bluntly excoriated the court's initial formulation of this doctrine and its relevance in subsequent cases. Turning to the question of equity, I think that Ellie was prescient in his analysis in the paper in the late 1970s, which he subsequently developed more length in aspects of the administration of international justice. Now, this interest in equity was obviously sparked by an increased reference to equity and equitable principles by international tribunals, particularly the International Court, or in treaties, which, as Ellie said, are really intended to refer to elements in legal decision which have no objectively identifiable normative content. Ellie saw the use of equity as resulting in increased decision, increased discretion on the part of decision makers because it's an inherently subjective concept. Even if the application of equity is based on the enumeration of factors which should be taken into account, Ellie did not see this as a shackle on judicial discretion. He argued, "It cannot be said that even the mere listing of factors involves no predetermination of their respective roles and thus does not significantly limit the discretion which the basic provision vests in the adjudicator." Now, Ellie had based a fair bit of his initial analysis on critical, incisive, and pertinent analyses of the North Sea Continental Shelf cases and the UK-France Channel arbitration. Now, quite interesting, this elicited a letter from Gerald Fitzmaurice, which is quoted in aspects of the administration of international justice. Fitzmaurice agreed with Ellie's strictures on the failure to identify the content and source of equitable principles employed by tribunals. But Fitzmaurice continued, "Where the tribunal is precluded by its statute or its terms of reference from deciding ex aequo et bono, but in fact is doing just that, it cannot avow it and has to take refuge in silence." Now, while Ellie saw dangers in the use of equity, particularly the extent of discretion it confers on decision makers, which has the consequence that there's a lack of legal certainty, he thought that this was not necessarily a bad thing, because it reflected an attempt to solve a problem, particularly in a treaty text. And he said, "We must not be so idealistic as to deny that even a poor result in negotiation is better than none at all," which might have relevance for Brexit, if you think about it. However, if we go back to equity, I think his views on equity can be seen to tie in with his criticism of consensual jurisdiction, because Ellie saw the use of equity as necessitating some form of third-party decision-making in the last resort, whether this was judicial or by conciliation. But he wondered if international litigation, as it currently stands, was a suitable or an appropriate mechanism. Because of the subjective and discretionary nature of equity, he argued that when a tribunal resorts to equity, it's not applying the law, but is creating the law for the parties. And a problem that he perceived was that a tribunal might not have enough knowledge to do this adequately. And so he argued that there should be an interchange between the bench and the parties on the standards and factors to be involved. He drew a parallel with legislation, which, and I think he was maybe being a bit idealistic, he said he thought that legislation should not be adopted without an understanding of all the relevant elements. And he wondered, I quote, "Why should we be prepared to accept less when it comes to lawmaking in the international community through this process of third-party settlement?" However, on equity, I think I should end with another characteristic Ellie comment. He said, "Attractive though the concept of equity may be in many situations, And perhaps as beyond criticism as is mother love, it is not a concept that can be sprinkled like salt on every part of the law. So that's Ellie in cooking again. Now, finally, despite Ellie's manifest attachment to the complexities and the niceties of international litigation, he was also very clear on its limitations. He exhorted the students attending his Hague Academy lectures, and those of us reading them, that the first rule of international litigation is to avoid it, if at all possible. Thank you.